probably about 5 minutes before we sat, we just watching all the people that just piling up and all. I just told that boy, thank you, bro. That boy said, for what? I said, man, for getting me, bringing me out here. I said, man, you just had no idea, bro, what I was doing before I was on the stage out here. Like, and doing brass band. I'm like, man, you saved my life. Big fella changed my life.
I always had dreams of traveling the world playing music. Shit, man, Benny P took my music career to a whole nother level.
Huge part of the whole production from the beginning to now, so. And they're still living through the music.
Good evening. It's 7 o'clock, and you are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, streaming on the web at www.cfrc.ca. We're broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall at Queen's University in Kingston on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory, and this is Prison Radio. Okay, so that's some Hot 8 Brass Band with Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone. Great tune, great cover. I'm Malka, one of your hosts here on Prison Radio. Prison Radio is a once monthly show that features interviews and analysis, sometimes music, sometimes all kinds of stuff that really focuses on prison issues, carceral logics, and kind of related ideas. We also host another once monthly show, which is called Calls from Home, which is a show that any listeners can participate in by calling in advance and leaving your messages, requests, and song dedications for your friends and comrades, and or even from strangers who are in incarcerated in prisons in the area of CFRC's signal. CFRC's radio signal can reach 9 institutions: Millhaven, Bath, Collins Bay, Frontenac, Joyceville, Pittsburgh, Sundance Youth Detention Center, as well as the Cape Vincent Correctional Facility in New York. And anyone can contact us with a message or song request to air. We share letters, emails, voice messages, and music requests, like we said, for your friends or your loved ones on the inside. We have our upcoming shows for the rest of 2025 are taking place on October 1st, October 29th, November 26th, and December 24th. So please call or contact us one day before. You can call or text 613-917-1390. Email us at cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net, or contact us and message us on Instagram at cfrcprisonradio, which also I recommend you check out and follow if you want to stay on top of news for the shows. And finally, you can send us a letter to CPR, care of CFRC, Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6.
And for tonight's show, we have an interview with Andrew Zonnefeld. Andrew Zonnefeld is an author. He's published, his most recent book that he's published is called All Will Be Equalized, Georgia's Freedom Seekers of the Swamps, Backwoods, and Sea Islands from 1526 to 1890. This book has stories of oppressed peoples of African, Indigenous, and European descent who lived and fought together for their collective liberation while building multiracial and directly democratic communities within Georgia's most remote and secluded natural landscapes. So we talk with Andrew about, you know, mainly his book, but all sorts of things. His different anarchist influences for his book, the writing of history. And I'm going to play the interview now, and it'll start with Andrew Zonnefeld introducing himself. I hope you enjoy the show.
My name is Andrew Zonnefeld. I'm a independent historian and a longtime activist and organizer from Atlanta. I'm the co-founder of On Our Own Authority Publishing and the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology, and also of Community Books, which is a small independent radical bookstore in Stone Mountain, Georgia, which is where I'm from. And I'm the author of All Will Be Equalized, Georgia's Freedom Seekers of the Swamps, Backwoods, and Sea Islands from 1526 to 1890.
Do you want to tell us just a little bit of a synopsis of your book?
Yeah, well, the book follows the history of who we call freedom seekers in our research institute. We didn't come up with that term, but we kind of expanded it to include anybody who was trying to escape from violence of slavery or settler colonial society during the historical period in question and reestablish new societies elsewhere in which people could live freely in a community of equals, and also, in many cases, fight back against the expansion of slavery and settler colonial society. And so the story kind of begins with the very first slave revolt in what's now North America, which happened in 1526 down on the coast of Georgia, very near to where my colleague Modibo Kadali is from. Those of us in the Autonomous Research Institute, we have these local connections that we investigate, and through investigating, you know, what might even be called hyper-local histories, we are able to draw some pretty expansive lessons about history, about the writing of history, and about the meaning of human social motion that we can, you know, learn and carry forward, carry certain lessons forward from there. And so the story, like I said, begins in 1526, takes us through the Spanish colonial period of southern Georgia, what's today southern Georgia and Florida, and then takes us into the founding of the Georgia colony, to the American War for Independence, the War of 1812, on up into the Civil War, and follows the struggles of this really large multiracial class of people as they try to continually fight back against, like I said, slavery and settler colonial society on the peripheries of that emerging American empire.
It covers a lot. I really enjoyed reading it and liked it. Was a lot of history, but the way that you wrote it is easy for me as someone who has a hard time reading nonfiction to read, so really appreciated that. Thank you. There's a lot of storytelling. Great. Yeah, thank you.
Because you always wonder, right? And you don't ever want to write something that is annoying to read or indecipherable, or because it's in academia, people learn to write terribly.
Yes. Really true.
It's one thing that academia excels at is teaching how to write horribly.
Yes.
And so it's really, I really appreciate that compliment. For me, it's when people tell you why they didn't like history class or something in high school, and they'll often say it's boring, it's hard to fault them for that, you know, because sometimes it is boring if you write it boring. Just write it better.
Truly. Yeah, and I don't know. I feel maybe part of that is the direction of which you're writing it from. Like, part of why history was very boring for me in school is because it was just like, here's this colonist guy, and then this colonist guy, and then this colonist guy, and like, that's history. So
it's just a fucking list.
Yeah, it's just a list and lots of map coloring. This is definitely not that.
I just wanted to also say, I think for me, one reason I find this type of history interesting is because it's coming at it from a different paradigm that is, I mean, in the book, you call it critical historiography. And I know you also come at it from an anarchist perspective. But like, the things you pick up on and the stories that you tell in this book run completely against the grain of the traditional historical narrative. And so I think not only is that like fresh and new in a way that I'm not used to, because it's just limited what you can read that's like that, but it also, you pick up on all this frankly crazy shit that like no one ever writes about. But then when you see the stories of the shit that people did, it's just mind-blowing. I don't know. Yeah. I don't want to be too rambly. It is really cool. Liz and I were kind of talking about all this stuff about pirates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how
so cool.
Cool that is. Yeah. Just on like a base level, it's very exciting to read about.
I can't take any credit for the pirate stuff because everything I know about pirates, I learned from Marcus Rediger.
Cool.
Who I don't even know, and I wish I knew him. And he's a great historian. I cite him frequently. He's absolutely like, I'm not somebody who gets too excited over celebrity stuff, but to me, Marcus Rediker is like my biggest celebrity. I love his writing to death. And not only is he a remarkable and accomplished historian, his perspective is one of ordinary people's collective social motion. I don't know if he's an anarchist, but I think he certainly has some anarchist sensibilities to him. His book, Villains of All Nations, is definitely the best book on pirates. So if you like the pirate stuff, get that book.
I will.
Villains of All Nations by Marcus Rediker. And it's short and it's so well written. Like, he's writing. Talk about somebody who can write. His writing is just really good. You know, it reads like a novel.
Cool.
You know? So I'm a big, big fan of his. And so anytime, in fact, I almost anything I write, I try to be like, can I squeeze a Rediker reference?
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
It was convenient telling the story, you know, in Georgia on the coast, we have Blackbeard Island, you know, so like the pirates were around, you know.
Wow.
In the period in which I'm writing about in the book, certainly. That's also what's so interesting about this person, Francisco Menendez. And for people who haven't read the book yet, Francisco Menendez is a black man who escaped slavery. He fought against the English in the Yamasee Wars. And when they were defeated, he and it's not just him. So I don't want to get too caught up in the individual of it all. But he's an interesting nexus through which to view the period. So he fights in the Yamasee Wars. When that doesn't go well, he and all of the people he was fighting alongside, they flee to Spanish territory and they establish this town called Fort Mose, right above, right 2 miles north of St. Augustine. And then that becomes the first legally recognized free black town in North America that is recorded anyway. Oglethorpe, who was the colonial figure who founded the state of Georgia or the colony of Georgia, he attacks Fort Mose. That fort's destroyed. And then Francisco Menendez and everybody, they live integrated into St. Augustine, you know, in the late 18th century, not even late 18th century, like mid 18th century. And then Francisco Menendez goes pirating. He becomes a pirate. And then he gets captured, re-enslaved, escapes slavery again, comes back to St. Augustine, helped start a second Fort Mose, and then eventually everybody evacuates to Cuba after the Treaty of 1763. But like, just from following that one guy's life, you can see all this stuff. You can see the Yamasee Wars, you can see the pirate thing, You can see the Fort Moses establishment and these various experiments in black autonomy and different styles of maroonage and stuff like that. So, yeah, so I typically like to look at things a little bit more broad than one individual, but sometimes you can look at an individual and be like, wow, that guy didn't miss anything in his life. And Francisco Menendez is one of those characters.
Just backing up a little bit, can you explain the style of history that you're using when you write this book, Critical Historiography?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. So historiography is the study of how history is written. And then critical historiography is the kind of interrogating of the biases and prejudices inherent in the writing of history. And so when me or my colleague Modibo, when we talk about critical historiography, we're looking at, we're constantly interrogating how history's been written and why it might have been written that way and whose interests it serves and stuff like that. We by no means invented the practice. But one thing that we do take it a step further, we try to write things from always the perspective of ordinary people's collective social motion toward self-liberation and self-emancipation. And that's where like the anarchist element comes in. And we emphasize themes of like direct democracy and social ecology and feminism and certainly queer history and anything that avoids this teleological view of history where everything that came before is just like one step towards what it is now. One of the things that is a personal gripe for both me and Modibo, and I keep mentioning him a lot because it was really his perspective that inspired me to write this book on Georgia. But one thing that really annoys us both is the tendency of everyone, historian and non-historian alike, to project Jim Crow further back into history than it actually was. Because there's a tendency that we can think of history as this inherently kind of progressive march. You know, like Dr. King said, the moral arc of history bends towards justice or something like that. But the truth is much more complicated and, in fact, even more interesting than that. There's been people at every stage of history who believed in and practiced as much as possible the maximum amount of human freedom that they could. And stories from multiple points of history that would make people today in the 21st century go, wow, that's amazing. I never knew people could even live that way, let alone that it was happening 300 years ago, 400 years ago, 500 years ago. And even sometimes under incredibly oppressive circumstances, you know, people found ways to create societies that in some ways may even have been more free than we're used to living now. I know that's like a loaded term and that's maybe a subjective opinion, but people can read the book and they can tell me what they think. So that's kind of what we're always looking for. And then we're also looking to put those histories in conversation with one another, because there's another tendency where like you get so siloed in history that you can overlook simultaneous things going on because you're only a scholar who's interested in one little area. Of course, nobody can do everything because we don't have infinite brain capacity, but like we try to look for places where we can put these different liberating traditions in conversation with one another. And that was definitely part of this book, because in this book you have black freedom seekers, African descended freedom seekers who are typically identified as Maroons by historians, also indigenous freedom seekers of various many backgrounds, Georgia, Florida area, but in particular the Timucua and the Wali, who also later become known as the Yamasee. And then you also have this interesting group of white people that were known at the time as crackers, which later became kind of a pejorative for poor white people. And it was a pejorative at the time, but it was poor white people who were known for their associations with people of color specifically in these clandestine and, I guess technically criminal freedom-seeking communities. So the book is telling the collective story of this group because they really were together. And it's the critical historiography angle that allows us to look at that and not just say, we're not doing a thing where we're going to only study one subset of this group of freedom seekers because they didn't exist in isolation. You know, they existed alongside and in the same communities, sometimes in the same households as comrades of many different diverse backgrounds.
Yeah, that was one of the kind of interesting and really new parts of the book, the way you framed that kind of solidarity amongst those people as also necessary for them to gain more freedom collectively and then the really targeted history of trying to undermine that solidarity. And I was thinking a little bit particularly about some of the lessons from your book that could apply to abolitionist organizing. And I think that the kind of history of slave patrols into police, I think, is one that a lot of activists know, but I didn't know about the class elements of the beginnings of that and how the people who were slave patrols directly benefited from financially from keeping those slaves, and that they had a hard time recruiting people who didn't, and that they really had to cultivate that racial hate and propagandize that further down. And
yeah, so, that white supremacy is not an organic thing. Yeah. It had to be created.
Yeah. I think that the way that you're describing studying history really does bring that to light a little bit more. And it's easier to see those patterns of people always seeking freedom. And it's much more inspiring than just being on a wave of progress that you don't really have a lot of control over.
That sound? That's the sound of a healthy, well-cared-for cat. I truly hope you've been lucky enough to hear that sound before. The feral cat population around Kingston and the surrounding areas has grown considerably over the last few years. And thanks to organizations like Kendra's Community Kitties, these feral cats are being fed, medically cared for, spayed, neutered, flea-treated, dewormed, given winter shelters, and placed in loving homes whenever possible.
Hundreds of these special animals have been rescued by Kendra, and many of these wonderful felines are purring right now, safe and healthy.
Wow. But rescuing and rehoming feral cats isn't easy. It requires an enormous amount of time and effort, and there are a few ways you can help.
You can donate to Kendra's Community Kitties on their website, kckitties.com. Even a small amount will help pay for medication, spay and neutering procedures, and food and supplies to keep these felines sheltered and healthy in the cold winters or extreme heat of the summer. Because some of these kitties are not socialized, Kendra has committed herself to provide 22 dishes of food with fresh water every day, 365 days a year, to 6 feral colonies. Food prices have increased significantly, so donations of food and money are always needed. Funding assists with the process of finding homes for these cats as well, as it takes time and money to find the right individual or family to be matched with the right kind of cat. You can become a foster family for our feline friends. Go to kckitties.com and learn how you can care for and love a cat or even a family of kittens until they can be moved into their forever homes. At the colonies, Kendra plants the seeds of trust and socializes the feral felines when she brings them food at the same time each and every single day. So they're more accepting of humans when placed with foster families. But fostering a feral cat is no easy task. Kendra cannot take these cats from the colonies unless there are foster homes willing to commit to help these kitties gain trust with humans.
You can adopt one of these special cats or kittens. If you've already been thinking of getting a furry friend, reach out to Kendra at kckitties.com and she'll provide you with all the information you need to make this important decision.
Any help you can offer from this community kitties will be tremendously appreciated. Not only by Kendra, but by the lucky feral felines she rescues.
And hey, maybe, just maybe, one day you'll get to hear
Panda say I love you.
Are there other particular, like, abolitionist kind of lessons that you think can be gleaned from the book or that pop out to you?
The big one for me, and I don't know if I really articulated it in the book, but I think that it might be implicit, is that you might notice that the abolitionist movement of the later period, you know, like, let's say between, let's say from 1776 on or something, the abolitionist movement is not mentioned much in the book. But what is talked about in the book is the direct action of enslaved people against their enslavement and the people who found common cause with them. And so it's interesting that one could kind of like just refer to all of these people as abolitionists, but I don't think that they necessarily articulated those politics themselves, although they may have. Well, they articulated the politics certainly in that they were against slavery, but I don't think that the abolitionists who were in a more within the political class or within the middle and upper classes of especially in the North, where the abolitionist movement was more pronounced, I don't think that they necessarily were aware of these people until maybe Nat Turner, right? Mm-hmm. I think that that inspires a question of like, what is the meaning of abolitionist? And I haven't totally teased that out, but, you know, there were certainly some famous abolitionists who identified as abolitionists who had been enslaved, Frederick Douglass, of course, being the most well-known. But in general, those people who were fighting for their freedom didn't necessarily, as far as I can tell, they weren't necessarily connected to that political movement. Mm-hmm. Of course, they might have been. Some people might have. There were always people who were against slavery and were propagandizing against slavery and doing an excellent job at that in all over the South, and, you know, either openly or clandestinely. But I think that what's more interesting than a movement that calls itself abolitionist is the direct action of people striving for abolition, which is perhaps a different thing. And maybe I'm just splitting hairs here, but I think there's something to it. And I think another big lesson of the book is abolition means abolition.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean a kinder, gentler model of oppression.
Yeah.
And so in today's culture, especially among people who call themselves abolitionists, you might find people who are like, yeah, abolish the police, except in Cuba, or abolish the police, except in China.
Yeah.
You know, or we'll abolish the police here, but in China and Cuba, they can wait a little while. It's all good. The state will one day wither away, and those police will abolish themselves. Obviously, this is an ahistorical line of thinking that has persisted, you know, since some of the earliest Marxist period, but now we've had many historical experiments with that thinking, and we know it doesn't work that way.
No.
And so you could look at this history. If you were like a kind of a campist kind of person who were like, we have to support the less oppressive empire in a given region, you could, and there are historians who have, you could read the history of Florida and be like, Spain are the good guys, because the English were doing slavery way harder in North America. Of course, in South America, the situation is very different. But it's the part of that kind of Stalinistic campist mindset to kind of cherry pick what areas of human rights you're kind of concerned about. And human rights is even a weird term.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by our friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present a selection from Hylia's new EP, The Piano Sessions, which was recorded with just one microphone and a grand piano. Local artist Hylia reimagines a collection of covers in her own unique style in this new release, and unlike her earlier recordings, the new release is stripped down and raw, capturing the intimacy and authenticity of her live solo performances. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream the Piano Sessions by Hylia on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Gold Dust Woman right now here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
So I wanted to really make sure that we properly embarrassed the ruling elites of all of these empires and all of these colonies in this book. To wit, you'll see a particular attention paid to Oglethorpe. James Edward Oglethorpe, he was an English aristocrat, and he came up with this interesting idea because there were so many enslaved people fleeing from the Carolinas to Spanish Florida. He said, what we're going to do is we're going to create a new colony between the two in that contested zone where there's all these, you know, maroons and renegades living. We're going to create a new colony there. We're going to call it Georgia after Your Highness, King George, and we're going to make it whites only. So that if you see a black man or any person of color, you know that they're up to something. But to do that, we can't allow slavery in that colony. So that made Georgia the only one of the original 13 colonies that was founded with a prohibition against slavery. And which a lot of people who are only kind of like vaguely familiar with the histories of the South and slavery, they might not realize that. So that makes Oglethorpe, though, seem like a pretty, if read in a certain way, oh, Oglethorpe founded Georgia as a colony without slavery. That sounds like a really progressive dude. And in fact, there is a book written by the CEO of DeKalb County, which is where I live, Michael Thurman. And he wrote a book recently, like last year, the year before or something, a biography of Oglethorpe, in which he argues that Oglethorpe was an abolitionist. Now, Oglethorpe, as I had mentioned earlier, attacked and destroyed the only known legally recognized free black town on the continent, which is Fort Mosé, outside of St. Augustine. If you only know that about Oglethorpe, then this argument of General Oglethorpe, later Governor Oglethorpe, being some kind of abolitionist is just patently ridiculous. And yet, it sounds really good to liberals. Sorry, Michael Thurman even said in one of his book talks in Savannah that he wanted to see a musical akin to Hamilton produced to tell the story of James Edward Oglethorpe because, you know, he thought the story was every bit as compelling. Of course, the Hamilton thing is the exact same problem.
Yes, so much propaganda. So,
but it's so funny that he made that connection because when I was looking at his work, I was like, it sounds like he's trying to Hamilton Oglethorpe. And then sure enough, he said it.
Literally was. Yeah, that's really yeah. Crazy. Well, yeah, what you've effectively described him doing is creating like a giant border state, like mm-hmm. a state yeah. that's like just white people and like a alarm triggered yeah. every time. Yeah.
Like a buffer zone to defend slavery. Basically.
Yes. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
But the point is that there are no progressive ruling elites. They don't exist. And they never can, and they never do in history. So what exists is different efforts to propagandize around these people's agendas to pitch them for the benefit of whatever political projects is happening in whatever time that we find ourselves directly writing. So whether that's, depending on the agenda, you know, you'll see liberalism try to pick out these great men of history that were like ahead of their time or something, even when they're extreme, like even when they're slave owners, right? Or even, yeah. You know, I mean, it's just terrible. And obviously the conservatives do this all the time as well for their own nefarious reasons.
So I was going to ask you if there's been any update on the situation with the Okefenokee Swamp and the mining project. And then I also just Googled it, and I saw that a conservation group purchased a big tract of 8,000 acres of land where they were going to mine. And so I guess that mining is postponed for another day?
Yeah. As far as I understand it, it's a win on our end. Now, I would, if somebody else is closer to that situation and later wants to correct me, I welcome the correction. But yeah, it definitely, for all of humanity and for the earth, and especially for the people who live down there in the area surrounding the swamp, it's a major win. It's one of those things where nobody wanted this damn thing. For people who aren't familiar with the Okefenokee Swamp, it's a big, big, vast swampland that straddles the border of Georgia and Florida. And it's been called one of the last remaining intact freshwater ecosystems on Earth.
Wow.
Not in Georgia, not in the United States, on Earth. And I guess intact meaning it functions roughly the same way that it did prior to the Industrial Revolution, right? Mm. So, like, in terms of the
ecology. Ecosystem. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were going to be mining. The mining company was planning to mine for titanium directly adjacent to the protected area. Like literally abutting the protected area of the what's called the wildlife preservation area. And the mining was basically, for geological reasons, basically if they had been conducting mining in that area, there's a chance that they could have like permanently drained the swamp by accident, like at any given time. Like, it's very, very dangerous. And because of climate change, we already see days in which the swamp is way lower than it should be. There was a famous viral video of like hundreds of alligators in the Okefenokee Swamp, like kind of thrashing about. And it was kind of shared like jokingly, like, oh, like a kind of a joking, like come to Georgia kind of video or something. But it was like actually because the water was just really low that day and all the gators only had one place to go. But anyway, that's already happening. And so the threat was really pronounced. And we were going to be losing this precious, one of the most precious freshwater ecosystems on the planet. We're going to be losing that to mine something called titania, which is a version of titanium, the purpose of which is solely, as I understand it, solely to whiten toothpaste and whiten deodorant and whiten white paint. That's all it's used for. And so the trade-off for destroying this ecosystem is simply to make toothpaste white. It means it's patently ridiculous. And it's like, I mean, can you believe it? Like, I don't think people care that their toothpaste is white.
No.
As much as they would care, like, if they saw what they were about to lose, you know what I mean? But that's capitalism for you, right? And then, you know, I was talking about this with Modibo Kadali, who I mentioned earlier, and he was like, yeah, they don't care what it's for, man. They just want to find something they can sell, and they want to sell. It's like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And that's the problem. So the fact that there was such a concerted effort to, one, pressure the state to slow this thing down, and then, two, somehow get enough money together to buy the land out from under the mining company, that's a hell of a win.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy with how it turned out.
That's amazing.
But it has been really difficult to get more of the direct action oriented ecological activists paying attention to that one, because it's not near any major urban centers, so it's like hard to like do anything. You can't be in university and also like, you know what I mean? It's not.
You'd have to drive like multiple hours out there. Yeah.
You know, it's 5-6 hours away, maybe a little longer. Yeah, and it's in the middle of nowhere, but it was a win, which is great, and I think that we can learn a lot from that.
Yeah. Very happy to hear that. Is there anything else about the book you want to talk about, like favorite parts or stories you haven't mentioned?
Well, if y'all are in Canada, we got to talk about the Canada connection, which you might have noticed that there are some freedom seekers who carried with them these traditions that we've talked about from... Okay, well, let me say two things. I want to first talk about what happened in 1526 so that people understand what this is all rooted in. In 1526, Spanish explorers and intended settlers came to the eastern coast of North America from Hispaniola, today's Haiti, and they brought with them, with intending to settle somewhere on the eastern coast of North America, they brought with them 100 enslaved African men, specifically men. And where they ended up attempting to create their colony was on today's Georgia coast, just inland from Sapelo Island and St. Catharines Island in the Sapelo Sound there. Pretty close probably to what today would be called Harris Neck, which has its own fascinating history that you read about in the book. And in that colony, that first attempted Spanish colony, basically they didn't know anything about the ecology of the region. They did not dig their latrines properly to account for the change in the level of the water table. And they poisoned themselves. They gave themselves dysentery. And everybody got really sick. A lot of people started dying. And then the leader of the colony died, because these are colonialists, very hierarchical kind of organization. So the leader of the attempted colony, he dies, and a power struggle ensues to see who's going to be the next head honcho of this diarrhea town or whatever. And in that struggle, the enslaved African people who were there see an opportunity for emancipation, and they take it. And they take it in concert with indigenous Wali people who are pissed off because the Spanish have been raiding their communal food stores, which up to that point had never needed to be guarded, because people didn't just steal food like that. This is a new concept to the area. So the Spaniards had been raiding the food stores. The Wali were pissed. Obviously, the enslaved African folks there, they had every right to be pissed as well. And so together they set fire to several buildings and escape off into the night. And presumably these 100 Africans, or I mean, I don't know how many potentially died by then, but I'm not sure. But basically the surviving Africans presumably went on to live in the Wali communities for the rest of their lives. So this was the first moment of Afro-Indigenous Maroonage in North America. The very first moment. It was also, of course, these were the first African people brought to North America ever. A lot of people think it's 1619 up in the north somewhere.
Roanoke?
Yeah, but it was, the first instance was in 1526 on the Georgia coast. The 1619 date is if you're interested in English colonial history, but Spanish were here as well. In any case, so it's the first enslaved people brought to the continent. It's the first rebellion against slavery, and it's successful. And it was animated by a spirit of Afro-Indigenous solidarity. And it's that same spirit and a lot of that same solidarity that animates all the rest of the stories in the book, as increasingly large numbers of people throughout the proliferation of settler colonial society, increasingly large number of people are escaping, and these communities become increasingly more diverse and continue to engage in combative relationships with the settler colonies of both English and Spanish origin. So that tradition exists from 1526 on. And then you have the American War for Independence, followed soon after by the War of 1812. In both of those conflicts, you had people who escaped to British lines, and there was a British policy to undermine. And again, it's not an enlightened, not an issue of the British being more enlightened than the Americans. It's purely a strategic concern for the British. They want to undermine the American economy the same way later on in the Civil War the Abraham Lincoln does the Emancipation Proclamation to undermine the Southern economy by encouraging labor rebellions. So the British are doing this. Say, if you can come to British lines, we'll give you your freedom and some land somewhere in the empire. Of course, they give them the coldest, harshest, rockiest fucking land in the empire. Yep. In Nova Scotia, where like literally nothing grows. And I've spent quite a bit of time there. It's some rocky land. You can see it. Still nothing growing.
No topsoil. No.
Yeah, no topsoil at all. Yeah. So in, especially after the War of 1812, or at the very end of it, you had 2,000 freedom seekers who got on boats and went to Nova Scotia from Cumberland Island, Georgia. They weren't all enslaved on Cumberland Island. They were enslaved in several of the islands in the area and also in the interior. But they escaped to Cumberland Island because a British admiral, Cochrane, was using it for, Cockburn or something, was using it for his base of operations. And so there was a huge wave of what they called the Black Refugees. And then previously, in the 1776 war, they were called Black Loyalists, but it's really the same social motion. And so these traditions of self-emancipation went north to Nova Scotia, and so did a lot of the what we now call Gullah Geechee culture. And a lot of people are not aware of it, but there's some pronounced similarities there. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into it because it's the subject of some future writing, but like there's going to be there's a lot to learn to take. You can take this same story, you could cut off the first half of my book, and instead of keeping it in Georgia, you could write the second half in Nova Scotia, and it would still be pretty interesting. So, I just want to, I like to shout out Nova Scotia because I just find that place fascinating. I really do.
You know, reading your book, it's clear you have a lot of influences, both like intellectually, but also just kind of relationally. I mean, you and Modibo Kadali do a lot of collaboration, and that always shines through in like the most wonderful way possible, frankly. I just wanted to ask, what are kind of some of the other influences that are informing your work? I mean, I know you cite Murray Bookchin, and I certainly see that coming through.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many. I mentioned Marcus Rediker earlier. That's a big one. I really like Rediker's work. Another really big one, both professionally and personally, is UC Kwayana, who is an elder, not only historian, but major cultural figure in Guyana. He is 100 years old this year.
Whoa.
He's a remarkable, remarkable man. And his works, and I think in terms of what was influential on this book, his work, The Scars of Bondage, which is a history of slavery in Guyana, definitely influenced mine because of the way that he writes. UC is one of these people who, again, always writes from the perspective of what ordinary people are doing in their collective creativity and self-organization. And so I definitely learned a lot of that from him. And I've had the honor and privilege of working with him directly on two of his republished works. So he's high up on the list. And another one of my favorite books, and I'm not sure how much it comes through with this book, but a favorite book of mine ever in terms of history was Carolyn Merchant's Death of Nature. In terms of good books on ecology, there's not much better. Like it's a story or a history of the scientific revolution told through the lens of gender and ecology. It's an excellent book. One of those books that like will make you rethink the way you think just by telling you history. Just by telling you history. That's all it is. The best historians can just tell you what the fuck happened and then make you flip your head upside down and be like, whoa. The worst historians are the ones, in my view, it's not as desirable to editorialize and explain the significance of everything all the time. Mm-hmm. You want to try to do that as little as possible. You want to let the events speak for themselves by the way you thread them together. And Carolyn Merchant is excellent at that. But But Yusi Quayana is a master at it. I really, really dig his work. So that's, I don't know. I mean, there's just so many. I've got bookshelves full of people whose work I just fucking love. So it's there's going to be somebody that I regret not mentioning. Well, and let me just say this one other person. I want to shout out William C. Anderson, the author of Nation on No Map. William is is just a brilliant, brilliant writer. Every time I talk to him, he's like, he's just three steps ahead of everybody else all the time. I really dig the way he thinks, and Cindy Milstein too, who I think a lot of listeners in Montreal might know Cindy well. Cindy's somebody who I can always talk through ideas with, and then also in Nova Scotia, Art Bauman, who organizes a lot there, and is a an established musician in Halifax. Art is a freaking genius, and I absolutely love talking with him. Anytime I'm not sure where I'm going, I'll just bring up the topic nonchalantly with Art, and then we just like go at it for a couple hours, and then I walk away knowing how better to write something, and Art is none the wiser. Yeah, I trick a lot of people into helping me. And then for the next book, another dear friend in Canada, Janica McKenzie, is an archivist. Janica McKenzie in Truro has been so helpful on my upcoming book. So sometimes your influences are just the people that you meet who have like been wondering about these questions, or who are just like really excellent at being nerds. You come to them with a question, they're like, I don't know, but let's look into that. And like, you know, they know some sources and you know some sources and stuff like that. The list could go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. But I, you know, that's the wonderful thing about history. History is always collaborative, always. Even if you don't get along with anybody and you're just writing by yourself in your room, you have to collaborate with the historians who came before you. Mm-hmm. Because you're reading their works and you have to cite them or else you're being unethical. And then on top of that, you're collaborating with the people in the time and place and what they wrote about themselves or what they said about themselves or what they did and how their actions spoke for them. You're right in a collaborative relationship with them too. And so they influence your, or should influence your writing entirely. So I love that about history, because you're never alone, ever. You're always writing with others, even if they're not around anymore.
Join CFRC on September 28th at the Broom Factory at 9:30 a.m. for our Airwave YGK Sound Tech Workshop. Rob Bailey of Kingston Soundworks will facilitate this hands-on workshop for young emerging musicians just starting out playing gigs. Come learn soundboard tech, terminology, troubleshooting, communications, equipment setup, and soundcheck basics with this local industry pro. Register now for the free workshop, make in-person connections with local musicians at a prestigious venue, and learn the ropes of sound mixing to help you get started with your live stage performances. The fun starts at 9:30 a.m. on September 28th at Broom Factory and includes a catered lunch from our friends at Old Farm Fine Foods. Register now via cfrc.ca. The CFRC Airwave YGK Workshop.
All right, welcome to the second hour of Girly So Groovy, the only show dedicated to the women who rock and, of course, to you, the listener who loves them. A show where the music